listen, be guided, learn, and be very adaptive.
You're listening to Patterns and Meaning, a podcast by Seed Global Health. We find meaning in patterns, connect history to the present, and illuminate the way forward in global health. I am your host, Edem Tokunu. Our guest today is Thembile Mugori, who is popularly known as Thembi. Thembi is the Senior Advisor for Health Sector Performance and Sustainability at IntraHealth International. She is a UK State Registered Nurse and State Certified Midwife. She also has a Master's in Public Health and has worked in the industry for over 20 years. Thembi has extensive experience and expertise in policy and strategy development, clinical service delivery strengthening, health system strengthening, and the integration of maternal and child health, family planning, and HIV services. Welcome to Patterns and Meaning, Thembi.
Yeah, thank you, Ademi.
So you basically trained in the UK in Glasgow, but then you did a lot of your beginning work in Zimbabwe, Uganda, or on the African continent. What I wanted to ask is how different, or when you went to now start putting in practice what you had learned during your training, did you see any difference between what you had studied and what you were doing on the ground?
Certainly, I think I remember in my training in Scotland, including my midwifery was in England, and going back to Zimbabwe, then a number of things surprised me or made me reflect on my own training and made me reflect on the entire pre-service education of nursing and its better preparing nurses to work in different environments. I think one of the things that I remember saying to somebody, that people like me don't know anything about malaria, management of malaria, which was very basic. And I think tetanus, those things shocked my colleagues who had been trained in country, just like those gaps were shocking to me. When I trained as a midwife, the maternity that I worked in was very well equipped, literally with everything. I mean, we had patients in one room. There was one-on-one. You could hook your patient for labor monitoring onto a machine. And I remember definitely going to a maternity ward and thinking, no, I could never work here. I really could never work here where everything is so manual and the deliveries are so many. And I didn't. I actually didn't practice as a midwife for quite some time. Because I had those tensions. Even within the pre-service education, I also realized that while the curriculum was very much similar to my curriculum from Scotland, which had those gaps, they were just those subtle additions. If a child comes with fever, think malaria, which I wasn't trained to think. Think malaria. If somebody comes with a certain symptoms like tetanus, think tetanus, which I wasn't trained to think. But the textbooks, the really everything was very much modeled on the British system. And this was this for me was quite remarkable. Here is a such situation responding to local health needs, and yet using Margaret Miles, using all the textbooks that I had used in my nursing and midwifery education in England, and also realizing that my own nursing and midwifery education was very responsive to the needs of the healthcare in England. And there was emphasis on cardiac diseases. There was emphasis on intensive care nursing. There was emphasis on the things that were obvious there. So that really, I think, shocked my colleagues that you don't know anything about malaria. Just like certain things shocked me. I remember deciding to myself that I needed to learn. I registered very easily with the Zimbabwe Nursing Council. They accredited my British training without any need for additional training. And I remember even questioning that I think you need to look at what I covered. If malaria is so common, if some of these diseases are so common and I didn't learn them, how do I become credited and become equal to somebody you people have trained in your system who has more? You probably need a bridging course for us before you register me, so that there's a motivation from me to learn, because I needed to register to practice. I needed to register to be able to teach. I needed to register to be able to do my work in that environment. And yet there really wasn't a bridging gap. And I think we find this quite a lot. I also remember working now in a technical advisor role, and we're looking at pre-service education curricula in a couple of countries. And I was saying, you know, HIV, TB are very much in your faces. You go to a ward, that's what your students will see. AIDS-related complications, and yet you have so little time for it and or absent in your pre-service education curriculum. How do you respond? And yet very much on the British system, you have exactly the same hour allocation for those conditions that I would find very easily in my training in Scotland or in my work as a nurse in England. I was likely, very, very likely in a month to see a cardiac arrest. And I said, your students would probably never see that, but they will see TB. They will see AIDS the very day they get into a clinical area, into a medical ward. And yet you are giving it very, very little time and attention. And there was a lot of pushback. Their curriculum would not meet the international standards. They need nurses to be able to have the flexibility to migrate.
Oh, this is in the country that you were in at the time.
Yes.
Okay.
Nurses needed to have the qualifications to be able to migrate. Nursing is an international qualification, is an international profession. And agreed, yes, it is. But I think, just like the advice I gave to Zimbabwe, that when you are registering people that have trained outside, look at what they have covered and compatibility before you register them on their council. Otherwise, create some kind of bridging courses to make sure that they are, when you say they are meeting your requirements fully, they are meeting your requirements fully to be able to be nurses in those areas without taking their own self-initiative to learn.
Yeah, so how long, if I may ask, how long ago was this? And do you think the system has changed a little now, where there's a bridging course, or where the curriculum has been made to have a lot of local content, taking into account what kind of diseases are going to be seen in the wards in that country?
I think there is a shift. I think I think I've seen very, very recently, as recent as 2 years, one to two years ago, I have seen curricula in a couple of countries in East Africa that have really, as much as possible, tried to address the responsiveness to local health contexts and included that. But one of the things I remember remarking is that you end up with an overloaded curriculum, because they've tried as much as possible to retain some of the content from their kind of very much colonial modeled curricula, the international curricula, and added this. I think that effort has to be commended because it's an effort that is being made, this awareness. Do I think it's enough? I think the answer for me is no. I think we people who work in the international development, health development sector have gone in and tried to bridge that with in-service education, with in-service training, and saying, okay, we need HIV, we will prepare you for HIV. We need you to do emergency obstetric care. We'll prepare you in service for emergency obstetric care. And whilst it's very good because we are addressing competency gaps, I think it is for a lot of the regions. And I heard that being said, but I don't think it's been said hard enough that when you have people that have all these in-service training courses that they have done and they are still registered like everybody else who has remained maybe in a place where they don't do HIV and AIDS and their counterparts have that, how does that benefit career progression on an equal playing field? How do you then define that nurse who has these in-service training courses and experience behind them vis-a-vis their counterpart who graduated at the same time as them and has not had the opportunity to receive this extra training? And I think it was being talked in the context of, should we accredit these additional nurses, these additional courses that are provided during in-service training? Yes, they need to be accredited, but what does that mean for regulation in terms of regulation of nurses and midwives in these various countries?
And you mentioned something that's leading me to my next question, which is, over the course of your career, what are ways that you continue to see colonial and neo-colonial influences shaping nursing and midwifery education, the training and leadership in African countries?
Okay, I think let's start with right from capacity. In the last decade, I think a number of countries did include the degreed nurses. The one that has a college degree, the BSN, including masters, including PhD. They also have made that as a requirement for jobs in nursing administration, in nursing faculty, which is really very good. And they've also put that as a requirement for if you are going to be teaching in nursing, in pre-service education, a basic degree in nursing is a requirement. And when you kind of look back and look where we are, I always say you can kind of tell which country got help from which development partner in terms of their pre-service education. Yes, because you can see the modeling. You can see, I think I have seen countries where they used to have the enrolled nurse model, which is very much on the UK. They've just have registered nurses plus the enrolled nurses who were very practical, they were trained for a shorter period, and somebody came and said, no, do away with the enrolled nurses, make everybody a registered nurse and have the degree nursing. And some countries are now going back to that enrolled nurses because somebody came in. I think part of what has influenced that is that whilst we created the degreed educated nurses to fill in those vacancies, to try and bring in more experience and more academic background into nursing, there are not that many. That's one. The other capacity limitation is funding to be able to rapidly respond to the changing landscape in our health sectors and the changing needs in the health sector. So we have accepted technical assistance because it comes with its own resources. It comes with its own, and I think part of what I'm seeing is a change right now is that we are now coming to them and saying, when is the cutoff score? When is enough? When does a country then remain and be able to run its own pre-service education without the external technical assistance or without external technical thing? Can it happen? Yes, I think there is need for both that has perpetuated both colonialism and neocolonialism. That's one. And the second thing that has also perpetuated is, let's face it, countries like Australia, the United Kingdom, are still what I call receiving countries. They need manpower. They need human resources. And they will recruit. They will recruit from their former colonies. They will recruit from Ghana. They will recruit from Nigeria. They will recruit from Zimbabwe. They will recruit from all these countries because they know that those nurses are fairly well trained. You don't need to do too much with them to make them functional in a British system. And therefore, the encouragement for them to perpetuate that neocolonialism is there because it's self-serving, it's self-interest, it's meeting their needs. Never mind that it might not be meeting the needs in Zimbabwe. So that's the way we have perpetuated is that really it's whose interests do we serve? And neocolonialism is perpetuated by the colonizers continuing to serve their interests and not 100% under the guise that we are helping you.
Wow. So when this topic comes up, my question is, what can we put in place in the countries that feed these neocolonial systems? Or what can we put in place in Ghana, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, to let people stay instead of being enticed to go to go and serve in another country?
I actually do not think that retaining people in their country 100% is necessarily a good idea. I think people should be free to move, but their preparation as nurses, as midwives, should not be primarily be based on the flexibility to migrate, the flexibility to go and work in another country. I think that when receiving countries are making investments in improving pre-service education in Malawi, in Ghana, in Zimbabwe, our own gatekeepers, who are our own ministries of health, our own regulatory councils, who those are the ones I call our own gatekeepers, should actually look at how best those investments, which we still need, can be utilized to ensure that they are fully, we are still producing this nurse, this midwife, who can fully function in a Zimbabwe environment as a primary reason for training them. And that looks at, let's look at our curriculum. Let's look at our regulatory systems, because I think receiving countries can afford to have bridging courses. If I've not done cardiac nursing in Zimbabwe or myocardial infarction, if they employ me, then they should be able to bridge those gaps, not to impose them on these receiving countries. I think that's one. And the second thing I think that there's always this evidence base. There's always these standards. We are looking at now where there is introduction of research, gathering our own capacity in some of our own countries so that we are using our own data that has been collected by our own people and to make decisions that would fit or that would feed into curriculum revision, curricular development, and what our needs are. And I think that's also I'm seeing as a positive move that we are looking really at both qualitative and quantitative research methodology and introducing that in pre-service education. The other one is this whole community orientation, which we have neglected because most of our training institutions are very much urban-centered. There are very few in the rural areas. And I don't remember the student nurses that I taught never went to a rural area for attachment. But a number of countries are doing that. A number of countries are seconding, spending time doing your community health in a rural area at a rural health center to better prepare you, for that. But that tension of, are we ever going to have curricula that has no leaning towards the colonial curricula that we inherited is work in progress.
So now what I want to ask is, how do we equip nurses and midwives to lead while they are providing care?
I think that's another area that's also very, very, a weak area in our education, in our pre-education systems. When I was trained, particularly as a midwife in England, I was told you're a practitioner in your own right. There were some leadership skills that were included in that pre-service education curricula and really just decision-making. Nurses do a lot of decision-making, and yet the leadership has not been recognized. I think in our process, in our career ladders and career progressions, we have promoted good nurses. The ones that work hard, that are very excellent bedside nurses, we take them and make them administrators as a way of rewarding them for their very good work. I think we need to ensure that curricula, right from the beginning, picks in those leadership and management duties of a nurse and leadership roles of a nurse. Put it, they will be able to come out as leaders, because some of them, if you are the registered nurse and you get posted to the rural health facility, you're going to find yourself the leader in that rural health facility, because you are the only professional nurse there. You are going to find yourself the manager. And we wonder why sometimes there isn't this, why they've stock out, because they've not ordered, because we didn't adequately prepare them. And I think it should start right from pre-service education, right into when we get to the degreed nurses. And at that level, you then have to do, are they going to be administrators and managers? Are they going to be teachers? Are they going to be various? You tranche them into those various skills that you need. But right now, the only way we can bridge that again is through in-service training. I think having those professional associations and regulatory councils strengthen their capacity to be able to lead these initiatives, because they know what is needed. They know the leadership skills that is required and what level, and just provide them with the resources to be able to do it. And I believe they can do it. I met a lot of very, very excellent nurse leaders on the continent that can also even role model, because that's the other thing. A lot of us learned from what we saw as role models in our professions, and they can role model that in their, deliberately role model those leadership skills in their professions.
And in terms of decolonizing nursing and midwifery education and training, what are some transformative activities already underway, and what are some successful models that countries can emulate?
I think in terms of decolonizing nursing and midwifery education, I see a lot of effort being made in this area. I see very strong linkages with pre-service education, service delivery, regulatory councils coming together as the health landscape is changing, as those service delivery or service policies and guidelines and strategies are being made. There are a number of countries that are making deliberate efforts to ensure that pre-service education, particularly for nurses and midwives, being the majority of the health workforce, are represented and adequately represented through their faculty, through their associations, plus the actual frontline nurses and midwives. I think that's one thing that I've seen is a major step. They then can go back into pre-service education and say, if the country is going this way, we have these gaps, and make decisions on how they try and bridge those gaps. I've also realized that nursing education is really moving towards different transformative approaches. One being the whole competency-based training or case-based learning that is coming, and looking at the family as a whole. What I've seen in some countries, it has pushed countries to say, what are the ultimate competencies that we require of this nurse when we deploy them? And changing the curricula, the way it is written, to actually make sure that you have those learning outcomes and you are describing the learning objectives in that format. I think one country that I can cite that people can look at is Tanzania. Their curricula is laid out in such a way that it actually thinks of the nursing in practice at the end of it. And that's why they formed their education. I'll come to another part. The other part that I've seen is a lot of efforts for interprofessional education, having a module which covers team training for nurses and midwives to recognize their unique role and their importance within a team. Not so much taking orders, but within a team learning. The gap that I actually see is the curricula, some of this curricula, like I'm citing the one in Tanzania that I can cite fairly quickly, coming out with those learning outcomes, the expected competencies, and very well written to respond to that, those competencies. The teaching itself, due to limited faculty, and what happens in the clinical area due to shortages of health workers, or the lack of focus on training the ward sister, the ward RN, to role model, to teach, to take on these additional roles, in as much as their job description says you shall teach. Nobody's prepared them to be able to do skills transfer very adequately. Plus the shortages of health workers, I think we are still in that transformation, still need to pay more attention to what happens in the clinical area. I think because that's for me, when you are talking competency-based training, a very, very critical piece of it. And I think there are still some challenges in that transformative teaching, in that the infrastructure that we have also is under development for some of these transformative learning approaches that we are bringing in to pre-service education. for it to be fully realized. One of the things that I feel is that at a debate somewhere where you have nursing faculty, professional associations, plus administrators, all that nursing block within the continent, is to really say, if you were to have an ideal infrastructure that is not driven from outside, that would meet your needs for competency-based nursing and midwifery education in your country, what would that infrastructure look like? Because we still bring in, if you send me right now to Tanzania, I'm going to bring in whatever I can lay my hands on from here to that environment. Does it work best? Probably not. I always joke that when I was in PTS in Scotland, we used to have the dummy, white dummy we used to practice on, called Mrs. Smith, and I've seen Mrs. Smith exactly as she is on the continent.
No change in Mrs. Smith.
And yet, I've also seen on the continent that them really nurses that have tried their best to be very innovative and create some things that are very interesting, except that we really don't recognize that. I think you need that platform where you say to them, okay, you want to teach somebody and you don't have a pelvis, you don't have the fetal head for you to rotate, what would you do? And I've seen some very, very innovative dummies, except they're not produced in mass, but they work for them in that environment. So there are innovative people out there, and there are people that know and understand their needs. The only thing is that they don't have those resources to come together at a platform. And when the resources are now brought by us, the development world, people in the development sector, we really just bring what our resources can purchase. And we don't have the time and energy to do that. And we bring the things that we think are the modern. I've heard this word "modern" used, the modern new things. Whereas that's really just modern perpetuating neocolonialism.
What is pre-service education, in-service education? And I've forgotten the third one you mentioned, but you mentioned three things that form a triangle.
Service delivery,
yes.
Okay. Pre-service education is like, I have never, I finished high school, and I have never been trained as a nurse, and I'm entering a nursing college for the first time. And that is pre-service education. It's marked into, I go into accredited training institutions that are recognized. I go into a well-developed system that is approved curricula, that is very well structured, and that leads out, the outcome of that is a professional qualification that I can then register and practice as a practitioner, as a nurse, or as a midwife. That for me is pre-service education. Then you have in-service training. I qualify, I'm already working, and I have some short courses to build competencies, either in new skills or either as refresher training, because new technologies come up, new policies have come up, or I'm kind of getting stale, and they are normally short. Some of them, like in some countries, I've seen they tend in-service training courses and awarded them professional development points. In other words, they actually contribute to your professional development and your relicenser and accreditation. So some of them are accredited, but some of them are just short. They are ad hoc, mostly funded and provided by global development health partners, and to bridge the gap and to meet again the needs of what they're doing. So you have courses in HIV, short courses in TB, in family planning, in sexually transmitted infections, in different kind of thing, neonatal resuscitation. There are so many. That's for me, falls the whole bulk of in-service training. I mentioned continuing professional education. Some countries, you renew your license. You renew your license with your regulatory council after 2 years, after 3 years. And part of that requirement does require that you have done so many continuing professional development credits. So you deliberately have these accredited courses that you do throughout the year, and you get your 10 points or 12 points. That's what you present to your regulatory council for your renewal of your license, or for re-registration, as they call it. That I find it's a good thing, but unfortunately in a lot of countries, it's also something that is developing. It's not fully developed in a lot of countries, that particularly I'm now talking on the Africa continent. That's something that I think for nurses and midwives, in a lot of countries for doctors, it has been fully developed, but for nurses and midwives, it's still work in progress. So those are some of the things. The one I mean about service delivery, which used to be the gap, I think one of the things is the expectation for people within the service delivery, which is mainly the Ministry of Health minus the education pieces that are responsible for policies, that are responsible for development of guidelines, that are responsible for ensuring that there's quality of care provided, need to link very closely with nurses and midwives in pre-service education. That linkage should be fairly seamless. I remember when I was in a country that I won't mention, we were doing a lot of in-service training for maternal and newborn health. And I thought we were doing refresher training, and we were getting these newly qualified midwives coming in for in-service training. And I remember talking with the district director of health services and saying, but what's happening? Why are you sending us these midwives? And his response actually shocked me. I have no confidence that I can deploy them and they can do safe deliveries in the health centers if I deploy them there. So I'm bridging them in with this in-service training that you are offering. And I said, but they just qualified. You should really have confidence and I took this message back to pre-service education and said, you know what? Some of those administrators in the districts where your midwives are being deployed are expressing lack of confidence. And it turned out he was right. Some of those nurses had just managed to fumble through their midwifery education. The examination is a written theory. They studied, they passed, and yet practically, they really could not do it. And that's another aspect countries are really trying to bring these practical assessments to make sure that you pass the practical assessments, you pass how to support a safe delivery, how to resuscitate a newborn, how to do various things, how to conduct a full antenatal visit. They're now doing that, this continuous assessment that focus on practical skills, because that's what was happening when you have this didactic system and they were going there. And I remember being very shocked that how can you say, because some of them were like, I graduated last month, they were coming for in-service training, and I thought they should not be here. They're just newly qualified. Their skills are fresh. And this doctor said, no, I have no confidence. I don't believe that I can let them loose on their own. So this is the element why they need to work very, very closely together. It's just like service delivery also needs that if a nurse or a midwife are regulated and they are registered by the council in that country, they can function and fully meet the health needs of the populations and communities in those countries.
This is my last question. What words do you have for that international development partner from a non-African country that is thinking of teaming up with the regulators or ministry or health the educators in an African country? They're thinking about teaming up to put together curricula. What would you say to them as they think up the standards and the things that should go into the curriculum?
One of the things that I would say to them is that, and say to me, is that you need to listen to them. It's their environment, it's their context, they live it on a day to day. You go in for 2 weeks, you go in for 3 weeks to help them update their curricula. You really, even if you read, you have no deep insight into what the requirements are and what the challenges are that they face and how to model that curriculum to meet their needs. I think you need to be guided by their expertise, even if it means bending what some of the things that you believe in within your international standard guidelines and your international evidence base. The evidence, their evidence is better than that, what you're condemning the international evidence base. I think we also need to be very adaptive. We need to be able to adapt to the situation. I think that's why that listening coming in and learning. I've been told and I've accepted it that, you know what, what you're saying will not work here. And you go, oh, okay. So if it's not work, and yet that's what I have brought. And I know the tendency because I'm serving that international platform. You try and advocate, you try and really push it from different angles. I agree with you, and I'm going to say it again. There are some great nurse leaders. There are some great nurse educators. There are some great nurse service providers and midwife service providers on that continent that have brilliant ideas that just can provide you something that would make for a very, very rich curriculum that is applicable in those different contexts. I think the other thing I always say, ICM in particular, they have those standards, those competencies for midwives. They will be the first ones to tell you they're not cast in stone. They are there to be adapted to different contexts. But sometimes the adaptation is what we don't do. I think the other thing that I will always say to those that are development partners that are helping is that think of that country after you, because you are only there for a short time. They are there continuously. Think of that time after you're gone. So whatever goes in there has to be practical for them, because some of these things fall by the wayside. You go in and you evaluate and you against your own international standards and you think, but what happened to this, which 5 years ago, XX helped them and it's not there. It's because it was not sustainable right from the beginning. It was not applicable right from the beginning. It was not responsive to your needs right from the beginning. So what suffers first is those things that are not applicable. So why spend a lot of resources on them? I think that's what I would say. Just listen, be guided, learn, and be very adaptive.
And with that, we would say thank you very much for the insightful conversation, Tembi. That was a fantastic conversation with Tembi. My key takeaway is, when it comes to nursing education, competency-based training is the way to go. So we need to take a leaf out of Tanzania's book and ensure that curriculum reflects its own learning outcomes. My second key takeaway is, international funders need to listen to the communities they are going to because they know themselves well and they know what they need. So funders need to allow themselves to be guided by their expertise.